Hey, this is Michael Lindsay from Vital MX, and if you were watching the video above, I imagine you've scrolled down and clicked the play button to hear a little bit more about the Alta. So, usually when we go to a bike intro, being that it's an updated model or even a fairly new model of something we've ridden before, it's a little easier to get the thoughts concise and get them into a fairly digestible video that we're able to get out there pretty quickly for everybody to enjoy. In this case, with the Alta being just such a different experience, I really couldn't go into all the detail I would have liked in video form, or otherwise you guys would have been watching a talking head for solid 30 minutes or something. So I've decided to sit down to a little bit of just raw input here on audio so you guys can listen in a little more. So I guess we'll start with the Altas itself. I'll go a little background on what experience I've had with them. So, of course, I think like a lot of you, I saw the original BRD pop up back in, I think, 2011 when they showed off their prototype online. Firsthand saw it in 2014 at AIM Expo. That was the first time I met some of the crew there, like Derek Dorsine that I interviewed for the technical side of it. He's the chief technical officer. And from there, we were just kind of waiting for it to come out. I know originally they'd hoped to get it on the market sellable a little bit quicker, but they finally got a completed, refined version of what we saw in 14, really out for full sale throughout the 2017 year. So starting there, what have I ridden before? My prior experience is only 3 laps, actually, on the Alta. It was a kind of a Redshift MX last year with quite a bit of a few changes to it, because it was actually Darren Durham's race bike for Straight Rhythm, and I rode on an outdoor track actually up at Zacha like 6 months ago. I only rode 4 or 5 laps, had supercross suspension, full tie hardware, had a little bit different size of the battery pack, but it was basically the same output as the normal Redshift MX. It was just set up to be a little bit lighter because they could afford a little less battery pack size for Straight Rhythm for the very little bit of time that the bike was running. I was really impressed that day. It was a little bit hard to judge exactly what the chassis was doing because the suspension was just so stiff and held up, but I was really impressed by the power output. They were claiming that, you know, we're competitive with a fairly strong 250F, and that's why I felt. I had ridden that track prior that morning on a 125, and I hit everything a lot easier on the Alta and jumped pretty much everything up there second lap. So came away impressed, didn't have a lot to say about it other than it's fairly comparable to the 250s they claim. So fast forward to what we got to do at Paris the other day. They had all the media out because they finally, you know, they've had a year under their belt. They had a new model with the MXR to go along with the normal MX that they wanted to introduce. So they brought us all out, gave us some equal time on everything, had their staff on hand to answer our questions. So starting with what we rode, they had their 2018 Redshift MX, which is slightly updated from the 17. And then their all new model, the MXR, actually don't know what the R stands for. I'm just going to go with race at this point because it just feels like a racier bike. So the updates to the standard Redshift MX, it's pretty minor. It's a couple little things around the foot peg area, a couple little like foot pegs, the actual mounting brackets where it rubs on the side legs, a couple things that got carried over to the MXR. The majority of the update lies with the battery pack and the algorithms and the controller unit, just some tweaks they made to it to get what they claim like an extra 2 horsepower and a little bit more torque out of it. I think that puts that bike somewhere, because I think they claim standard 40, so probably around 40 to 42-ish area for that bike. And then moving over to the MXR, it is, you know, I think a lot of people look at the battery pack and the controller and think, oh, is it a ripoff? Are they just, you know, typing in some different code and it makes it faster? Even though it looks different from the outside, it's actually a completely like different battery. The controller unit, the algorithms, all that stuff is new on the MXR. And then that, of course, it shares all the bodywork and the chassis of the MX. But then the other two really notable updates is tires. The standard MX comes with the Bridgestone Bowcross, which we haven't seen as popular, of course, on OEM decisions for bikes in a long time, and they haven't really been as much involved in racing. The tires, okay, but they went to the Dunlop MX3S on the MXR, and it's a big help. And then the other real major change, not only from components, but just also the way they set it up, is the MX comes with basically what's an older version of WP Shock and the 4CS fork. It's basically leftover components from a KTM from like 4 years ago that WP has sold them. They, of course, set it up for their bike, but it's just still a little bit limited in performance compared to the MXR, which comes with the latest version of the WP Shock that you would find on any KTM or Husqvarna motorcycle in the motocross classification, and it comes with WP's AER 48 air fork, which I know some people aren't a fan of air fork, but I'm sure as they've heard from a lot of our opinions, the WP one is really, really quite good all around. Definitely probably the best production air fork on the market. So what they've done from there is, you know, you go out on the standard, I guess we'll get into a little bit of the opinion now that we've covered what's new about them. So rolling out on the Redshift MX, like I said, I've had the opportunity to ride one for a couple laps, so I was able to get some of the initial shock factor out of my head, because you know, you imagine, okay, there's going to be no engine noise. That's got to be the hardest thing to get over. Yes and no, it's the lack of combustion engine noise. You still have the electric motor wearing, making its little zing noises. It's definitely a lot quieter. It's really silent compared to that, but there's a lot of other noises you have to adapt to that might take a second to wrap your head around. Of course, you think, oh, you'll hear a little more chain slap noise. I think the biggest standout is tire roll. It's amazing how much noise the tires make in this situation now that you can hear them. I swear probably any person that rides this the first time will think their tire is flat the first lap. It makes you hear the tire and the rubber rolling that much that you swear the tire's got to be flat. Doesn't feel like it is, but you swear by the sound it's got to be flat. So once you can get past the noise of how the tire sounds under acceleration, under braking, I think even as we rode quite a bit of a hard pack material, as you hear the front tire a lot on the jump face as you push up into it, you hear it slide and roll the rubber and roll the sidewall, and that's probably, to me, the sound-wise, one of the weirdest things to get over. But as I said, well, I rode one for a couple laps before, put that all in my mind. We rode a fairly tighter track of Paris. We had a lot of rain, so the main track was out of commission. We were on their what they call their amateur track. I think it would look like most people's local vet track. Doubles, tables, nothing really over about, I think the biggest table's maybe 60 feet. A lot of jumps in the 35 to 50 foot mark on this track. A lot of bowl corners, couple ruts on the inside. Pretty much with the Alta, jumped everything except for one big table on the very first lap. Jumping it wise, it's a little interesting. It's in two ways: the way it produces power coming up to the jumps and the way it jumps itself. It reminds me more of going back to a two-stroke. It feels like you get more of your speed set before you get to the obstacle. It's not as much if you roll out on a big 450 and you roll up to a jump first lap and you brap, 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 and grab like a handful and kind of seat it. The Alta, it's got so much torque, but it comes on in such a progressive manner. It doesn't feel the same when you try to roll up, and you can blip it on a face, but I feel like you do it a lot different. You still need to have more of that seat, that speed set, it feels like, before you get to the obstacle. And then once you jump it, it's got so little of inertia with the engine, you'd think, okay, how is this thing going to react? And it's definitely different. I always say, like, you know, you see a lot of guys at tracks these days hitting some probably bigger stuff than they should, because a 450 four-stroke flies. I mean, when it gets stepped out, it's sketchy. But if you know halfway what you're doing on the jump face and you go straight, they jump fairly neutral. You got to be pretty far off the back with a pretty big handful to get them to really want to loop all the way out. Otherwise, you can kind of sit anywhere on the bike and they just float a little naturally forward. Two strokes on the other hand, I know if a lot of guys jump back to them, they realize that if you sit a little too far back on the jump face, you boner air it a little bit. If you're a little too far forward, you definitely nose wheelie through the air, and it's easier to throw your body input into the jump, so it makes you a little more conscious on what you're going to do. The Alta feels a lot more like that, either one of them, the MX or the MXR. But they're not as crazy still as I would thought in the air. They've done a lot with the algorithm controls, how the bike will actually wind up in the air when you grab a bunch of throttle. Because I feel like when you take off, so like I said, it's a little more free, like the two-stroke. If you put a lot of front-end input, it will dive. If you seat bounce and sit really far back and don't correct your weight right on takeoff, you'll boner air it a little bit. But at the same time, once it gets moving, it actually is fairly controllable. it doesn't continue to loop either direction, which is nice too much. The biggest thing I was surprised about is the throttle input, because I notice when you're in the air and if you blip the throttle, that rear wheel does spin up really quick because of the electric motor producing 100% torque instantaneously. It will drop the rear end a little bit, but the controls kind of kick in, and even though you can hold it wide open, it won't allow the tire to just keep spinning up in the air radically is what it feels like. I don't know where the restriction is exactly in the system, but it's really neat is it doesn't allow it to just keep dropping out of control. It allows you to give it nice little inputs in the air, and within, I'd say, 3 or 4 laps, I was jumping fairly or extremely comfortably, and by the time I had switched more to the MXR, which we'll get to why the suspension works better for that, I was pushing into jump faces out over the front end, soaking up stuff, some of the doubles out of the corner, just kind of sliding the rear up a little bit, just able to jump it how I wanted, not a lot of worries. Like I said, a little bit bigger jumps, the one longer tail on the track and stuff that we'd see more on the main track might be a little more getting used to because of the way the power characteristic is, but overall it's not the giant adaption I thought it would be. Of course, the Alta guys talk about it is they've worked really hard to try to make this bike, you know, they want to keep the unique properties of it being an electric motocross bike, but they're also trying to make it easy to adapt to. They don't want it to feel so insanely foreign that riders just can't get on it and it just feels like some experience you just can't wrap your head around. Now, speaking of that, the experience itself, I guess backtracking a little bit to the sound side of things. So you hear the tires, you hear the chain. I think the tires really interesting. Just talking about that still is under acceleration, being able to hear it spin under braking. Where you can hear the engine whining up and down, you kind of rely on other senses. You rely, of course, on the feel of how the motor itself is pulling. And then also out of the corners, it's really interesting to be able to hear tires spin and regulate that. It's a different area to listen to, and if you kind of pick up on it, you can learn some really interesting things, I feel, about traction under acceleration, and also even the traction you're getting with the rear tire under braking, whether, you know, how much you're really locking it, if you're on that verge of locking it on off, if you're full skidding it, but in low material don't feel it, or if you're just not using enough rear brake and you don't even hear it lock at all at any point. Then, of course, other than that, just adaption-wise, you've got no clutch and no shifter. The no shifter thing's a little bit weird to get used to. I would say that takes maybe a lap or two until you're just like, okay, the power spread, that's just what I have to work with. I would say this is a very armchair comment because only ridden on fairly tire tracks. One time at Zacco, at Darren's bike, I'm not sure what the gearing was, but with the production setup, it feels very well spread across what I would consider first through maybe around fourth gear. I don't think it feels quite as widespread, of course, as say a modern 450 or 250F with a full range transmission, but it's plenty enough to get the job done on the majority of super motocross tracks I've touched with it. We're going to actually be getting a test bike here soon so we can opt it onto some different terrain, some different size tracks to confirm this, but it's more than adequate for what we're doing. But actually adapting to that, so the no shifter, no clutch. The no clutch thing isn't as hard to get used to as I thought it would be. I thought I would be missing it more coming out of corners up to jump faces, but because the electric motor produces this extremely progressive power that isn't as affected as much by load, and you don't have these low and high spots and power where it's just this consistency, you come out of a corner where normally you might roll out of a rut right into a jump face, you might, you know, bike's a little low in the RPM, you might be on the clutch a little bit to wake it up. The Alta, you just grab a bigger handful of throttle and it comes to life. It doesn't matter. Yes, softer material definitely takes more throttle input, but it doesn't affect it as much as a combustion bike would. So I feel like that's pretty quick to adapt to, the lack of the clutch maybe for obstacles. Where I did find it weird was the lack of clutch in ruts. And the only reason I say that is it's a little weird when you get in the middle of a rut and the electric motor winds all the way down and you roll through the middle of the corner, you sit down, you go to get back on the throttle. The way it winds up, it's a little different than a combustion bike. It it goes from an unloaded aspect in the middle of the corner because all the inertia is gone. The feel of the inertia is pretty gone. And then when you climb back on throttle, it loads up again. So I feel like it's on longer ruts, I struggled in the middle of the rut a little bit to just stay consistent. I felt like I was standing it up a little bit or kind of making two corners out of one. And I struggled with this for a few minutes, and actually the person that pointed out was Dennis Stapleton. He, like Chris Kiefer, had some hand in early development on this bike and later development. He made a joke about like driving go-karts at pole position or K1, the electric go-karts. He's like, you know, they tell you not to hold the brake in the corner while you're on the throttle, but you still do it anyways to load the motor up. You do the same thing. So after hearing that comment, I went out on a couple of ruts. I would drag the rear brake a little bit in the corner to kind of load the engine. It felt like in the middle of the rut, it would help load the bike and keep it kind of planted down in. So I just started doing that a little bit on the toe or even with front brake, just trying to get the bike to feel loaded in some way and be able to keep the RPM up a little bit in the corner, kind of faking without having a clutch. That's honestly the only real point that I was thinking to myself, oh, you know, I kind of wish that was there, but there's definitely a way around it. It's just something you wouldn't normally think of. Not coming from, of course, Ryan Bikes Forever with clutches. Now from there, let's talk a little bit. We're talking about the getting in the ruts and stuff. We might as well start talking about handling. So really impressive aspect with the Altai. I knew it when I rode Darren's bike, even with the Supercross suspension initially, was I thought it handled very well, especially the front end traction. If I had to give you a direct comparison to another motocross bike out there, I would say it kind of reminds me a lot of a Suzuki, like an RMZ 450. It's extremely planted on the front. There's a lot of really good feedback up there. It's just very, very planted. Now, what's a little unique is Alta's stock setup. I asked them before we went out, their stock sag is at only 90 millimeters, which if somebody hears that number on a modern day 450 or 250F, they're like, oh, this bike's going to feel like a stink bug. It's actually fairly better balanced than that. If I had to give you a weird comment, I would say it's, oh, the 90 feels more like 100 millimeters on a stair bike. It's a little high in the rear, but it's not as much as I thought it would. It's still very rideable. I didn't feel like the bike was extremely unbalanced at first until I rode it for a little bit. You know, the first couple laps, you're adapting to so much of the power and just the differences in riding it. After a little bit of just riding corners, the track we were riding, it was really advantageous to cut down in a lot of the corners to set up. So at first I was doing that because this bike does have so much front end bite. It was super easy to get the bike to squirt down out of corners whenever I wanted to. After a little bit, after the track changed up a little bit and I wanted to open up my lines, I found that it was a little bit hard to carry my momentum around a long berm or even more when I got in the ruts. Partially the clutch and partially what I'm about to talk about right, or lack of clutch and partially what I'm about to talk about right now, a little bit of that chassis setup. It's, you know, I know a lot of guys really like, for instance, the Suzuki feel or that lots of front end, that very planted feel. For me, I'm a little bit of a smaller guy that includes arm and leg features, so I'm fairly forward on a bike. I don't struggle with as much front end traction typically as many guys do. I don't know if it's my body positioning or what, but not to say I'm any good at corners. I still suck. from time to time, but I don't struggle with keeping the front end planted in corners. I actually struggle a lot with too much traction. I'm usually forward enough on the bike and I've got my core forward. I tend to climb out of corners early, so cutting down is not a problem. I struggle with being able to stay steady in long ruts and steady through long berms without feeling like I'm making multiple inputs. I just want to flow and have the bike have a certain amount of push in a way, just to allow it to be able to glide through a corner and keep a consistent arc without grabbing too much. So for me, we changed the sag a little bit. We never measured the end based on what I know for turns, what usually of a spring does. I think we set the bike around 96 to 98 millimeters instead. I might have even wanted to try a little more, but we basically took that rear end, squatted it down a little bit more. I changed the bar position. It was in the middle. I moved it to the back position of the three-post hole they have in the triple clamp. The idea was just trying to get the weight back, myself under braking and in the corners, and that was a big help for me in the ruts, just being able to lay that bike in. Once I got used to how it handled and getting adapted to the power and everything, it was really nice to switch that up, and it gave me a much more normal feel. It really didn't compromise the front end feel and the traction at all. I didn't think I really gave up too much. I could still squirt down a lot of places I wanted to, but it gave me a lot more rear end feel to rear steer it at times. The way it squatted under power was a little bit better for me, because I think one of the interesting things with the bike, they've done a really masterful job with the suspension. especially more on the MXR, which we'll at the very end get into the real comparisons of those two models. But it feels pretty normal to ride. The action of the suspension and what it does, I know they've had to change a lot of the settings to make it work like this compared to a normal bike, but they've been able to make it feel a lot like riding a normal 250F. The balance, the way it loads and unloads, like I said, the little bit of the middle corner thing is one thing that stands out to me. The other thing is a little bit is under acceleration, because it makes so much power initially with the torque and the way that curve carries and the way they've manipulated it with the algorithms to carry and make it rideable, is the bike squats under initial throttle. It squats down at a very good rate. It doesn't go too deep in the stroke. It feels really squats down a little bit and squirts out of the corner. But what I feel like is, as that power kind of continues at a steady rate, the bike doesn't have the big hits and loads that a combustion engine does. So I feel like the rear doesn't always stay squatted as much as it could. I feel like on some longer sections, the rear end starts to climb back out of the stroke a little earlier than I'd like. So if I was playing with it more, I would probably attempt some things with rebound or high-speed compression to keep changing that. That was one of the only real things that stood out to me. I feel like the fork, the stroke, the actual movement, both front and rear, is completely normal. The track we rode immediately was not rough at all. It was very smooth, just a lot of features to push the bike through, which was fun to be aggressive with it. Shows, especially with the newer bike, how aggressive they've set it up. I didn't feel like it was soft or like a toy at any point. It felt like I could push it just as hard as a 250 or 450 into a jump face and push through and kick it out a little bit and have some aggressive fun with it. The actual fit and feel of the bike, they've done a really unique job. Sit on it, I'd say middle of the bike, it doesn't feel that much different than a lot of machines out there. Forward, it reminds me a little bit of the previous generation Yamaha 450s, because the shrouds are, I think the term is convex. They come out and they bow out and then start to taper back at the end, where instead of being concave, where they are kind of in and they bow out at the last second, the angle, kind of the, you know, lack of the radiator and the battery pack being there. It's a little wide when you sit up on it in the front of a corner, but towards the rear of the bike with no exhaust or anything, the whole back of the bike is extremely consistent. It's one of the best, if not the best motorcycle I've ridden in terms of leg feel on the bike without them having to conform to a typical frame and subframe design. I feel like they've done a really great job of where the leg can contact the motorcycle and the feel I have off the back of the bike. And like I said, with the bike bounce, I didn't feel a lot of need to get that far forward, so I typically tried to stay middle of the back. I was really impressed with that. The bike does feel, it doesn't have the inertia, of course, of a combustion engine bike, so it feels lighter than it is, even though these bikes are respectively like 259 pounds and there's 267 or 68. They're definitely a little bit porky when you pull them off the stand, but in motion they feel way lighter than they really are. There are a few moments, like I said, ruts, a couple little things where I'm like, there's a little bit of weight here, but for the most part the lack of the inertia really tricks you into feeling how light they are, especially to me when you're standing on the bike, because of the feel they've done with it. To me, it's such a comfortable bike to be in the attack position. I felt like I stood a lot on this bike deeper into corners than I normally would, especially like rolling through bowl corners. I would stand very much through the top of them, even standing through little flat corners to accelerate. It just felt so comfortable to me in that position, and the feel I had along the bike made me prefer that a little bit more. So I'd say my sitting to standing ratio was a little bit different than a standard bike when I rode the Alta. I guess now we'll dive into a little bit of the differences, of course, between what we call the Redshift MX and the MXR. The Redshift MX is basically the model that they sold last year. They did, like I said, make some changes to algorithm controllers a little bit to get a little bit more power out of it this year, but it still has WP's 4CS fork, the older shock. When I ride that bike, it is fun. It's very impressive, but what stands out to me is there is a little more adaption. The suspension on it, I would compare more to, say, like a cross-country style dirt bike. It's based off a moto bike, but it's very soft. It's very spongy. It was a little harder to be aggressive on. It also made the bike feel heavier because it would bottom out easier. It'd push through more on jump faces, and it would get deep in the stroke going to the corner. It felt like the overall weight of the motorcycle was pulling itself around more. So the Redshift MX was fun, but that felt to be some of the drawbacks, was really with the suspension and what it allowed the rest of the bike to do around me. The power, what we did mostly is there is four maps. Mostly we ride them in map 2 and 4. 2 is kind of a mellower setup to start with. It's their middle of the road power. 3 is actually not that much more aggressive. It's a torque map. It's really good hard pack. It allows it to pull from a down low really well. Map 4, which is what, after I did like 2 warm-up laps, of course, I switched to on each bike, is their I think it's radical mapping is what they call it. It's basically turning into the race bike status. It really, really opens up and gives you the full punch everywhere. So on the standard Redshift MX, like I said, it feels a lot like comparable. It's a different type of power, but it's very comparable to a 250F. It's now, but what's not comparable is the way it does pull it. It's got a lot of hit initially, and then you just feel it start to taper a little bit. This taper, it kind of starts to remind you more of a bigger bore bike, where you feel like the power signs off later in the RPM. It just feels like this bike, as it pulls through the range, it starts to taper more and more. So it's really good on the tighter track. I wouldn't say that the standard MX feels as at home on a bigger, wide open track because of that. But that's one of the biggest differences moving over to, say, the MXR. So the MXR, like, talk about all the different suspension, the AR40 air fork and the newer WP shock. They're all their own settings on it. It feels a lot more aggressive. It's something that you can push so much harder into the jump faces. It has the standard feel and hold up, like I explained with some of my suspension thoughts. It feels a lot more like a normal motocross bike. I mean, it feels like a 250F that I've sourced up for myself. It's a very aggressive setting. It's super fun to push in and out sections. It gives you more that normal feel. And because it's more held up, yes, the MXR weighs 8 pounds less, but I would swear it feels like it weighs 30, something like 30 pounds less, some ridiculous number, because it doesn't push the stroke. You don't feel the weight of the bike carrying you around as much. Outside of that suspension difference, what really makes this bike, the MXR version, feel so much different is the power output. As we said, it looks similar. It's a really different battery unit and all the control units and everything. It really raises the output. The claimed horsepower on this thing is like 50 horsepower, and it's in the low 40 for foot-pounds of torque range. It feels really comparable to a 350 motocross bike in output. And I say that with the whole way it carries, actually. Like I said, it produces more torque than, of course, in a 350 initially, but it has this very progressive feel. And the biggest thing is, if you're comparing it to a combustion engine, is it feels like it pulls 3,000 RPM longer or something like that. It has this really good feel where you might compare it to revving to the moon or some term like that. It just feels like it continues to pull so much better from what I would consider mid-range on compared to the MX. It definitely, the MXR has a bit more output than the standard MX down off the crack of the throttle. But you just feel it build so much more. And then there's that crossover point where the normal MX just starts to taper off or start to feel like it's going a little flat, per se, where the MXR just continues to pull. For instance, you're landing off one jump on that track and you've got, I don't know, 150, let's just say 150 feet before the next obstacle. And it's a really fast section. The standard MX feels a little bit tapered getting to that jump face. You're staying on really hard until you get to the face because it just feel like it's gone a little bit flat, and you stay on throttle to carry that into it. The MXR, on the other hand, I'm actually doing like I would with, say, a big 450. I'm chopping the throttle 15 feet before the jump face because it's continued to accelerate all the way to that jump, and I'm actually going way too fast when I get to it. And I did that a couple times. I jump off the standard MX and jump on the MXR, both in map 4, and I would go and give it the beans off something, and I accidentally overshot a few things because, you know, the little bit lack of engine braking feel, a couple things threw me off a little bit. But as impressive as how much more that pulls, it feels like you're jumping on a bike with a completely different displacement. Overall, this just makes the MXR so much more aggressive, so much more fun. So a big talking point is, of course, they lowered the price a lot. The Redshift MX last year was basically $15,000. It's $10,500 this year. That's due to some changes. They've, you know, really locked down their suppliers, the materials, how much they're ordering. They've been able to do a lot of things now that they're up and moving as a company. They can produce these at a much quicker rate and get them out at better cost. They're starting to recoup some of those development prices. You know, it's to the point that they could definitely take a huge chunk out of it. Another reason, though, is it actually doesn't come standard with a charger anymore. That's not as big of a deal as I thought. They said that, I'm like, oh, there's probably $2,000 right there or something ridiculous. they have two chargers now. That's why the standard charger from last year that came with the bike is, I think, $500. It's pretty basic the way it's set up. And the charge time it offers on the standard MX, it's not much different. I think it goes from like two hours, 20 minutes. It shortens a little bit, the older one does like 2 hours, 20 minutes to the new charger, which brings it down a little bit. The new charger is $750. It's kind of more designed around the MXR. It gives a little bit boost to the standard MX, but if you put it on the MXR, it's more built for that bike. It drops the recharge time, I think they said, from something like 2.5 hours to 1.5 hours. Like, big cut. So, and it comes in a much nicer and easier to use case. And I think per one of the journalist questions when they asked one of the guys, so which charger do you recommend and buy? And one of the guys just pointed at that one, goes, just don't buy the same one. The other one's worth the $250. But so $750 for the good charger. We're down $4,500. So I mean, with a charger, realistically, it's like a $3,750 cut on price. That's big. The MXR, on the other hand, so they've got this new and improved great race bike that's aggressive. Okay, does that mean it's taking over the old price quota? No, it's not 15,000. It's actually just under 12,000. It's like 11,995. So, I mean, with that price change, we're getting down into a range that is a lot closer to buying a 450, putting pipe and suspension on it. It's closer into that range of what I would, a decent amount of people are spending on a new bike. So it becomes more of a viable option, I would say. Of course, depending upon how you look at it, I rode them. I had an absolutely amazing time riding these things. I was ear to ear grin the whole time. To replace my standard bike with one, that's still a pretty hard decision. It depends really on how you're going to use it. For me, of course, I want to go to the track and really burn out some motos. They had a good little generator set up there, but I was still having to wait for the bike to charge. And, depending upon how I set up my riding schedule or what I look like, if I'm just riding a moto or two after work, or if I'm actually going to burn motos on a weekend at a very aggressive pace, that's going to come into play on the decision. But what I'm getting after is the bike's becoming more of a viable option. I'm not saying it's going to replace your standard bike. There might be some people that are going to do that, and it's awesome if it fits in their schedule, because there's a couple reasons I'll get to why it's a really, really advantageous motorcycle. But I also think it's just a really viable option now for somebody that wants one. The price there with a normal bike, if they're kind of like, maybe they've got it, you got a normal motocross bike, you're looking for something else. This is in the range now of price, closer to your standard bike and something to look more towards. So covering that $1,500 price gap between the two bikes, which way I'd pick? Well, for me being mostly a track guy, hands down, MXR. All day long, every day of the week, I'll take the MXR. Partially, it makes more power. It actually lasts longer at that power. It just works so much better for any situation I would throw it in. I would say the standard even though it's called the MX, the standard MX to me at this point is, like I said, because of the suspension setup, it reminds me a little bit more of a cross country bike. I think it's a good all around motorcycle, but I was recommending somebody, I'm like, if you're really focused on taking the Alta to the track and being competitive, MXR. If you want one for fun, you're going to play around, do a little bit of all kinds of riding with it, build a backyard corner track, go play around on some trails, do a little bit of track riding, then I recommend you can save the $1,500 and go for the MX. Now, talking about those situations of price and advantageousness, so yeah, still the MXR at 12 grand sounds like a gnarly price. The biggest one they point out that's insane, though, is cost of maintenance. It's tires, chains, and sprockets. I think the gear, the whatever it's called, like a transfer case, whatever kind of gear oil it does run in, you only have to change it like some ridiculous amount. I have to double check this. It's like 60 hours or 80 hours, something insane. There's an hour use that they did for this. But anyways, it's almost never oil change. You're never putting fuel in. You never have to do a top end rebuild, a bottom end rebuild. There's no seals going out. You're not buying exhaust from. There's just a lot of parts that are, once you buy it, you could set up the suspension a little more, maybe switch the bars. But other than that, you don't have a lot of reoccurring costs. The electricity is cheaper than the fuel, of course, and ends up saving you down the road a lot of money. So, of course, things some other people go, well, okay, what happens when the battery pack finally goes out? What's the battery pack going to cost me? Is that more than an engine? I was initially skeptical of that. I'm like, okay, so what's this? Where's the hidden thing here? Am I going to have to buy a $3,000 battery every 2 years or something ridiculous? Currently, they said that these bikes, based on their testing, are good for 1,000 cycles. 1,000 cycles is charging it basically from dead to good to go again, good to ride. What that is relevant to in riding time really differs on how gnarly of a rider you are, but I mean, at the minimum of somebody like Durham's Talent riding one right now, I mean, that's 700, 800, 900 hours of riding. That's years and years and years. Imagine taking your 450 and putting 900 hours on it. Imagine how many times you're going to rebuild it in 900 hours. It's a big, big price saving right there. So I guess, yeah, the initial buy-in cost is a bit more, but if you realistically want to use one and ride one, if you're that guy that's got the opportunity to have a backyard track, or you just only have time to hit an hour moto after work and this thing just works for you, man, the maintenance side, you don't even have to, you know, no changing air filters, no engine oil, no mixing fuel, no just doing clutches and stuff. I mean, you know, you just come home, spray it off really lightly, spray some chain lube on it. You could cut an hour out of your day in bike work, if not more, for the major days you have to fix on. It's just easier to plug in and keep riding. So there's, you know, they have a point. You're losing the sound, you're losing the fuel, you know, you're losing some of those aspects of what you think makes a dirt bike a dirt bike, but it also offers up a certain simplicity that allows you to enjoy the riding aspect more than you would on a normal bike. There are certain aspects where it really is advantageous, and the experience it offers you is different. Yeah, it's not as good for some people in some way, but I think some of the aspects that it offers you for that experience are better. So, of course, get on to the ride time. I know a lot of people probably have a question, well, how long does the thing actually last realistically on the track? So, I will say my one downside with the standard Redshift MX, and it's partially why I don't recommend it as much for normal track use. When I rode Darren's bike the first time, I rode it at a very loamy Zacha station, very deep material. The battery life was fine. The ability to overheat the battery pack was a slight problem. Every couple laps, I would get a warning notice, and it would cut the power back a little bit. And I'd be like, okay, we have to wait for it to cool down. Some of the changes they did to that, the standard MX is still better, but even on the track we rode, I'd go out, and if I put four or five burner laps down as hard as I could, the warning light would come back up on the standard MX. So that's one side that, you know, playing around, doing some putt-putt riding on, some trails, some light moto, it doesn't happen. But if you're going to take it aggressive and seriously, it's going to happen, especially the softer the material gets. The MXR, on the other hand, I tried. I know a couple guys tried the day before me and some of the other big media outlets, and I tried to run it and see if it would happen. I put down close to like a 35. I didn't keep exact track of it. I think it was somewhere between 35 and 40 minutes. I went as hard as I could. The bike, other than a little bit of arm pump at times, I got a little sketchy doing a couple things. I was able to put a really good long moto at pace on it. I never got the MXR to even come close to doing the heat sink thing. That was a big improvement they've done with the MXR, is the way it cools and the way the battery pack disperses and controls heat and everything is much, much better. I still want to get it out on some really softer tracks and see if we can replicate it, but from my understanding, talking to guys, they've really been able to cut that down to a near non-existent problem on the MXR, which is big reason why I recommend it for the serious moto guy, because the standard MX, like I said, can get a little bit irritating in that aspect if you really want to lay it down, but the MXR just keeps going. So like I said, 35-40 minutes, that's what it took me to drain the pack wide open, as hard as I could push it at my skill level. That's what it took me to drain it on a motocross track. My understanding is like your average vet level rider, very middle of the road speed, can probably get a little over an hour of ride time on a full charge on the MXR. The standard Redshift MX is a little bit less, so it's neat. The MXR makes more power and it lasts longer at that output. Trail riding with them, flipping around, is much, much longer. It could be anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, depending upon how you're riding. Like, we had Nate Adams there, and he does freestyle on now, and he talks about riding like 4 30-minute sessions in his backyard. You know, a lot of putting around, but then hitting it hard on the ramps, going from jump to jump, and then cruising, and then jumping. He said he basically could go all morning playing around 3 4 4 34-minute sessions on it, park it, and it would still have battery in it. He'd plug it in for a little bit, eat a little lunch, and go back out and keep riding. It's funny, compared to a, you know, definitely a gas bike's very similar, depending upon how hard you're riding it, it changes, but the electric bike, it's an even bigger difference. It's a big spread compared on to what you're using it for. I'm just really impressed too, is the recharge time, like I said, on the good charger is down to an hour and a half from dead, and I mean dead, because that's what I did to mine. I rode it to the point it barely creeped into the pits. And we were back out there an hour later with a full battery, and I basically replicated this exact same moto time to down within around a minute or so. So I think another interesting question some people might have is, what happens when the battery goes dead? Well, the cool part is it tapers off at an extremely noticeable rate to warn you. In my case, it pops up a warning light when you're down to the last like 2% or 3%. And the first time it did that, I felt the power start to drop off. Like coming down straight away, I would say it tapered off a couple, like 2-3%. I just felt it wind down a little bit. And I was holding the throttle arm. I'm like, okay. I looked down. I saw the light. I'm like, okay, I need to go park this. I need to charge it. So I still rolled out my lap. I'm like, yeah, it's still very, very strong power. It just feels like it's down just a couple percent in what's giving me for output. So I parked and charged it. The second time out, I wanted to keep riding it to see what would happen. So I got the warning light, like whatever it was, 35, 36 minutes in, and I continued to ride the motorcycle for 4 more laps, I think. And I just felt that everywhere, it just, every couple seconds, it was probably tapering the power an extra percent. So it's not going to come up to a jump face to you and just run out of all this power all of a sudden. I came up jump face and I could feel it start to taper down a little bit, but not enough to even affect the distance I was going to jump. I just turned the throttle a little bit more, and I easily made what I was doing. It's not enough that it's like bogging on a normal bike. You just start to feel that power output drop a little bit, but you can ride multiple laps like that. And I would say after 4 laps, I was down maybe on actual power output, how much it was put into the ground. I felt like I'd lost maybe 40% of power over 4 laps or so. So I still had plenty to get around. It was definitely slower, but at no means did it do something ridiculous where it shut off and died. I just kept riding around the parking lot, and it just slowly gets to the point like the battery just winds down. So think of the flashlight starting to dim out, but forever, like just dimming out super slow. That's kind of how it feels. You're just like to the point you're just kind of creeping in, and it's dimming, dimming, dimming. That's what it felt like a lot to me. So it's kind of nice to know there isn't that danger per se of it running out. So a little safer than the gas bike when you run out. It doesn't tend to sputter and cough and shut off on jump faces. It gives you some nice little bit of warnings, and it still allows you to keep moving for a pretty decent amount of time before it gets you in some real trouble. I mean, that's quite a bit of information. I hope that helps a lot of you understand, or people that have not gotten the experience to try one of these yet, what it would sort of be like to get used to it, to get to riding one. Really, it's just a fun experience. Electric motors are very unique on the bike. The torque they produce, the instantaneousness of it, the power curve. Yes, it is a lot different than an internal combustion bike, but it's really interesting that the bike still feels so competitive and comparable in a way to the bikes that they're trying to build them to compete against. Yeah, it's not going to fit everybody's situation yet, but it's something, if you're interested in, they do a lot of demo rides, try to contact, they've got a growing dealer network. They've got enough. They've got one in every state now. Some states have more than one Alta dealer, but, I think it's getting pretty close to the 50 number, and they're trying to grow it, after only 1 year. It'll definitely grow this year. I know everybody's already going to pick on the negatives, the sound, the time, if you're actually a track and aggressive, but you know, reminder of the positives, the quiet thing. I know some people are really butthurt on the lack of noise. This isn't for our sport, blah, blah, blah. But man, there can be some real upsides with these bikes in the future. The ability of land to ride. I know, for instance, I was speaking to my older brother the other day, just moved to the outskirts of Denver. He's on, I think, like an acre and a half. And, you know, he wants to ride with his son out in the backyard. They've got enough room. I think it's maybe 2 acres. They got enough room to make a track, but not one that they could ride on 450 without ticking off their neighbors, who I think have horses, actually. He just bought a little electric offset trials bike for his son to ride. And he was asking me up and down about this bike the other day because it fits his situation really well. It gives him an opportunity to do something that he normally would not have. He's also, he's kind of thinking of other things. He's a hunting guy, go up and ride it up in the mountains kind of quietly. There's some unique aspects to it that that really open up the range. It's got its crossover of what it can do with a standard combustion bike as of now in its current form. There's a lot of things it can do that the combustion bike can do. There's things that a combustion-based bike can, you know, gas-powered bike can do that it can't. The range, to be able to re-extend it easier, the type of power still on some open tracks, some of the versatility of a gas bike, but then the electric bike still has its own level of versatility. So I think it's really unique. There's some crossover where you could utilize this bike for a lot of things you do a gas bike. There's still things a gas bike do better. There's no doubt about that. There's no arguing that. And there are things that this bike does better. So I guess that kind of caps it off. I hope you guys enjoy. If you have any more questions, please hit the comment section below. There's plenty of stuff on the forum. We've actually got probably from the time this piece launched, it's either next week or the week after, we're going to have CTO Derek Dornstein on to talk on the forum as a Q&A a bit about these bikes. So if you have really good in-depth questions, if you hear this before he comes on, get some questions ready. Look for that in the forum and on the homepage for when we launch that. You could ask him some really direct questions, maybe anything I haven't covered that's more on the real technical end. He could really go over you. It's really fun to talk to him, especially about development. There's so much unique thing that went into the algorithms of this bike. I could talk to that dude for 6 hours and not cover all my questions still. So anyways, thanks for tuning in for a quite long audio file here. I apologize for any of the birds you're hearing. I am outside in the wee hours of the morning, and they're really irritating, but we wanted to get you guys as much info as we could about these bikes, so enjoy, and make sure you check out VitalMX.com for more bike reviews, race coverage, all of our goodies. Have a good one.